It's Monday, February 4th, 2013. This is the Committee on Health and Human Services and Housing. Good morning. Our first order of business is Senate File Number 1. Senator Lori. Thank you, Senator Lori. Before you begin, I just would like to remind everyone who is here, we have quite a list of people who would like to testify. We're restricting presentations to 2 minutes. If you can get to your critical points during that time, that would be helpful. This bill, of course, has been through a number of committees already. There's a number of areas within the context of this bill that are not under the jurisdiction of our committee. For example, board composition and conflict of interest is not under the jurisdiction of our committee. Rulemaking is not under the jurisdiction of this committee. Data privacy is not under the jurisdiction of this committee. It's already been heard in judiciary. Rulemaking was in state and local government. Conflict of interest is also state and local government. Financing will be discussed in Finance and Tax Committee. And insurance producers was already discussed at length, a couple of hearings in the Commerce Committee. So it is a complex bill that has many jurisdictions. We're here in front of us today because there are elements of your bill, Senator Lori, that are of concern to the interests of this committee, which includes carriers and health plans, eligibility, and smart purchasing. So with that context, to help people who are here, for those of us listening to the bill and those who will be testifying, that what we'll be focusing on is carriers and health plans, eligibility, and smart purchasing. Senator Benson.
Hi, and Madam Chair, thank you. You have outlined the parts of the bill that are not the jurisdiction of that committee. Do you mean that members shouldn't ask questions related to those parts of the bill, or that the public testimony should not relate to parts of that bill?
I think we certainly want public testimony on those portions of the bill. That's what we're here to really, when it moves from this committee, the rest of the body is expecting that we will have reviewed those portions of the bill. So in terms of other questions from the committee, though, I think if there's a minimal question that could be asked, but to dig in on finance issues should be reserved for the Finance Committee. To dig in on issues related to rulemaking should belong to the appropriate committee rather than using the time that we really need to take a look at the portions of the bill that we're responsible for.
And Madam Chair, this is presumed to go to tax on Thursday. It's already scheduled. Are we presuming an outcome of this committee?
Depending on the outcome of this committee, it would go to taxes and then to finance.
But it's already scheduled in taxes. Did we prejudge an outcome?
I don't believe that it's been scheduled for taxes. We haven't.
Okay, submitted it's it to listed on public meeting notice as going to taxes, and so I just wanted to ask if we had prejudged the outcome of this committee.
I have no way of knowing what the outcome of this committee would be, and we haven't referred it anywhere from this committee as of yet. They may be looking at what they need to do in order to reserve time should it come to their committee, and that would be when they would reserve it for. But okay. Yeah, if it doesn't get referred there by this committee, it doesn't go there.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Lori.
And I will, briefly describe the entire bill. And I think that, I know that if a couple of members here, this will be the first time they've heard it. I don't think anybody will have heard it less than twice by the time we're done with it. But, and that's all good. We'll work with folks. I always start out with a couple of prefatory comments just to make sure people understand that I fully recognize how what a big change this is to a huge sector of Minnesota's economy, one that makes a big difference to our entire healthcare community and actually to our people and our small businesses, where they live and where they work. I really am taking all of the concerns seriously. I have a open-door policy. I've been trying to make sure that I balance the needs and come out with a bill that meets the needs of industry and consumers. And it's a difficult balancing act, but it is what we're trying to do. short little piece on the timelines. I know many people are often concerned about the abbreviated timeline that we're on here in the Minnesota legislature to get this bill out the door by the end of March. And I think it's important for that context to understand that we're not trying to railroad this or anything. It comes from some core requirements in the Affordable Care Act that we're trying to meet. Starting with January 1, 2014 is the date upon which these plans are going to be live and covering people's lives. And that's in the Affordable Care Act itself. There's no way to avoid that unless the feds were to change that law. And I don't think anybody, no matter where you're at on the spectrum, thinks that that's a likely outcome. So backing up from January 1, there's also a requirement of a 3-month open enrollment period. That covers October, November, December. So October 1st, all of the plans that are going to populate this marketplace need to be fully developed and all of the rates set. And that plan development and rate setting process covers that entire 6-month period between October 1st and April 1st and October 1st. And that's really an incredibly expedited timeline. Typically, that plan development timeline takes a full 2 years. And so we're asking the plans to get through that in a 6-month time window. That moves us all the way back to the March 31st that we submitted in our blueprint as a commitment to the feds in terms of when we would have the nuts and bolts pieces of the health insurance exchange ready to operate. To the process that we've been going through, this is committee number 4 of 9 in the Senate. And we have been honestly engaging in those fruitful conversations, and I truly believe really improving this bill at every stop. We had a fairly bare-bones bill, and we've been adding substance at each stop along the way. In state and local, we addressed and added a lot of substance to the rulemaking provisions in this bill. We addressed the board compensation and the state statutes that apply and those that are exempt, as is within the jurisdiction of the state and local division. In judiciary, we really added a lot of substance on the appeals process and clarified many of the data sharing provisions that are in the bill. In commerce, just last week, we had extensive testimony, and we adopted significant amendments to work with the brokers to make sure that their compensation structure is more in line with what they experience today and that the business model continues to work for all of our friends and neighbors in the broker community around the state. We also worked on the boundaries and the definitions around smart purchasing to be able to authorize the exchange to use our purchasing power to leverage the best deals on behalf of consumers. So we tried to narrow that a little bit. I'm not suggesting that it's a done deal or anything like that, but that's just the initial comments that I'd have. To the substance of the bill, Senate File 1 establishes a Minnesota-based health insurance exchange under the Affordable Care Act. The goal, really broadly, is to establish a consumer-friendly website and marketplace where Minnesotans can comparison shop on an apples-to-apples basis for health insurance policy that best meets their needs and access available federal tax credits and premium and cost-sharing supports. For those without internet, it's important to know that this bill also ensures alternative methods for accessing the exchange. The core components of the bill, again, I'm going to go rather quickly over those that aren't here, but I will cover each section. So Section 1 specifies in Chapter 13 that the classification and data sharing are governed in 62V06, a new section in this bill. Section 2 specifies that in the open meeting chapter that open meeting laws are governed under 62V03, another new section in this bill. Section 3 is the name of the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace. Section 4 is the definition of terms to be used throughout the bill. Section 5 creates the marketplace, with sub 1 listing the duties in four paragraphs. The first is to the duty is to promote innovation, competition, quality, value, market participation, affordability, meaningful choices, health improvement, care management, reduction of health disparities, and portability of health plans. The second duty broadly is to facilitate and simplify the comparison, choice, enrollment, and purchase of health plans for individuals purchasing in the individual market and employees and employers in the small group market. The third broad duty is to assist small employers with access to small business health insurance tax credits and to assist individuals with access to the public health care programs, premium assistance, and cost-sharing reductions, and certificates of exemption for individuals not subject to the responsibility requirements. And fourth, to facilitate the integration and transition of individuals between public health care programs and health plans in the individual market. Sub 2 outlines the applicability of other laws. Specifically, it's subject to the Office of the Legislative Auditor. The board is subject to the conflicts of interest and the gift ban. Requires all meetings of the board to comply with open meeting law, except those regarding personnel negotiations, contract negotiations, and not public or trade secret information. It's also exempt from Chapter 14, Administrative Procedures, except as specified elsewhere, and they are covered elsewhere with rulemaking. That's essentially rulemaking, and there are rulemaking procedures that were added back in state and local to make sure that we're doing the best by due process concerns. It specifies those procedures for adopting exempt rules and creates a process for setting of fees and legislative approval for the fees for the limited purpose of collection of the fees authorized in this act. Section 6 describes the governance structure with a board of directors consisting of 7 members, consisting of really 3 individual consumers, 3 industry stakeholders, and the commissioner of the Department of Human Services. It describes the terms of the board membership and describes the conflict of interest specifications for the board members. In Section 6, subdivisions 5 through 13 are really fairly technical, mostly state and local things, where the governor appoints a chair until the first meeting, which they elect their own. Chair has to be elected by a majority. They elect their own officers, spells out how board vacancy is filled. Removal can only be for cause. The board needs to meet at least quarterly, describes a quorum, and authorizes compensation for the board members, and the process for setting salaries in accordance with 15A0815 sub 5, and the appointing authority would submit those recommendations to the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and then it would come to the legislature for final approval. And also authorizes the board to establish necessary advisory committees. It's important to note that's a permissive advisory committees. Later on in the bill are mandatory advisory committees to ensure stakeholder engagement throughout the process. Section 7 describes the basic responsibilities of the marketplace. Sub 1 requires the marketplace to implement and operate in accordance with this chapter and requires that it, of course, apply with all applicable state and federal laws. Paragraph B authorizes the marketplace to employ personnel and delegate administrative and operational and other responsibilities to the director, establish a budget for the marketplace, seek and accept money, grants, loans, donations, materials, to contract for the receipt and provision of goods and services, and to enter into information sharing agreements, provided adequate protections and compliance with all applicable state and federal laws, regulations, and rules, and any other actions reasonably required to implement and administer its responsibilities. Subdivision 2, in Section 7, this is the financing, and the goal here is to ensure a stable and adequate funding source for funding the operations of the exchange. It establishes a premium withhold of up to 3.5% to fund the operations of the exchange, and this includes the funds provided for the Navigator program. Section 7, Subdivision 3, is the broker amendment that we offered in Commerce last week. Broadly, the goal here is to provide a compensation model for insurance brokers that preserves the status quo and provides a clear role for insurance brokers in this new marketplace. It provides brokers with necessary training for helping consumers purchase health insurance and access available tax credits and subsidies in the new marketplace. It's important to note that these training hours would qualify for continuing education for brokers. It also requires a fair and balanced approach to compensation for brokers between markets, where insurance brokers must be paid the same for plans sold inside the new marketplace as they are for plans outside the marketplace, and it ensures that brokers receive adequate payment for helping employers with defined contribution plans, a piece that's particularly important to small businesses trying to get a better deal. The amendment also required reasonable disclosure requirements by brokers to consumers regarding which carriers pay for their services, and clarifies that the licensure requirements and regulatory functions for brokers remain within the Department of Commerce. Subdivision 4, then, is regarding the Navigator program. Goal here is to meet the federal requirements to establish and fund a Navigator program that will provide impartial information on public and private coverage options and help individuals access available federal tax credits and subsidies through the exchange. An important aim of the Navigator program is to provide a system that better reaches and serves our underserved and traditionally uninsured populations. Navigators must conduct public education and outreach. They must facilitate enrollment into coverage, give assistance and referrals for complaints, and provide cultural and linguistic appropriate information and services. The bill allows the board to establish policies and procedures for ongoing operation of a Navigator program, as well as the federally funded in-person assister program, a call center, and a customer service program beginning January 1, 2015. For the first year of operations, calendar year 2014, the federal requirements for the Navigator program are met through the Minnesota Community Application Agent Program, that's the MNCA program operated through DHS. Entities or individuals eligible to be navigators can also serve as in-person assisters and can be compensated for services so long as they're not paid for as navigators. MMB will set the requirements and compensation for the Navigator program and in-person assister program within 30 days of an enactment, and that's the requirements and compensation structure that will be in operation for that first year. Under this proposal, counties will continue their current role and funding for the medical assistance program, for eligibility determinations, ongoing case management, and call center assistance. Consumers that choose to use the exchange online portal will continue to be able to receive case management supports from their counties. The exchange call center will utilize existing state resources and personnel and make referrals to counties for medical assistance questions. And counties will have the option to provide and be compensated for enrollment, consumer assistance for those eligible for the advanced premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions through the in-person assister program in 2014. That's a voluntary piece. If some counties do want to step forward and provide that in-person assister piece, they are allowed to do so. They are not required to do so. Starting in 2015, the board will establish the ongoing policies and procedures for the Navigator program and the in-person assister program, as well as call centers and customer service functions. Section 7, Subdivision 5 of the bill is regarding certification of health plans and carriers. And the goal here is to give the board the authority to get the best deals and the greatest value for consumers throughout this new marketplace. The bill gives the board the power to certify and select health plans to be offered in the marketplace if it determines that they are in the interest of consumers. In making this determination of interest of consumers, the board may consider affordability, quality and value of the health plans, promotion of initiatives to reduce health disparities, long-term cost containment, market stability, and meaningful choice and access of plans offered. The bill requires the board to go through the rulemaking process when establishing criteria for certifying health plans to participate in the exchange and provides for an appeals process for any carrier that believes they've been aggrieved by a board's decision in these regards. This provides the health industry with an opportunity to offer their expertise and input into this process and ensure that the board's process is transparent and fair. Due to time constraints for getting the operation of the exchange up and running for early enrollment in October, the bill requires the board to limit its selection process to considering specific value factors for that first year of operation. That's subdivision 6 is setting the appeals process. Subdivision 7 is the appeals process for the carriers that feel they're aggrieved. Subdivision 8 requires the board to establish and maintain agreements with the Office of Enterprise Technology, the Commissioner of Human Services, and the Commissioners of Commerce and Health. Subdivision 9 establishes the rulemaking procedures that we described briefly earlier. And Subdivision 10 authorizes the marketplace to use an expedited rulemaking process after January 1, 2014. It'll stabilize at a six-month expedited rulemaking process, but still allow for that public comment and contested case hearing on behalf of carriers. Subdivision 11 clarifies that dental plans are subject to the same provisions as health plans to the extent applicable. Section 8 is the data section with the goal to give the exchange the authority necessary under state law to access the data it will need to carry out required functions of a state-based exchange, including determining eligibility, facilitating enrollment, providing provider quality data, facilitating premium payments, creating personal marketplace accounts, and authenticating a user's identity. It also provides that data may only be shared with state and federal agencies when the board determines it is necessary to carry out the essential functions of the exchange. And it's important to note that nothing in the bill supersedes state and federal privacy laws for data practices, and that all of Chapter 13 for government data practices in the state of Minnesota is still applicable. Section 9 states that all funds received by the marketplace are deposited in a dedicated fund and appropriated and do not cancel. Section 10 requires a report to the legislature in January of every year regarding the performance of the marketplace operations, how the marketplace is meeting the responsibilities outlined earlier, and in a detailed accounting of the budget activities of the marketplace. Section 11 states that the board and advisory committees are not subject to the sunset provisions. They don't have to come back to the legislature for their continued existence. Section 12 authorizes the commissioner of MMB to operate the exchange until such time as the board is up and running and has their procedures running. That's how it's actually functioning today. Section 13 states that the commissioner of commerce, in consultation with the board of directors of the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, MCHA, will work together on appropriate phase out of the MCHA plans once guaranteed enrollment for these high-cost cases becomes available, and not before then. Section 14 is another required report back to the legislature on the appeals process for eligibility determinations. Section 15 is a section regarding multi-employer health plans. Currently, the feds do not allow for tax subsidies to flow through multi-employer health plans, and the multi-employer health plans cannot be a qualified health plan, but they function very, very well for a segment of our population, and there's concern that without those tax subsidies, this population will wind up coming to the exchange and will destabilize that multi-employer health plan model that has worked so well for this group. And so what this section does is says that if the feds fix this problem, the marketplace will comply with the federal regs as they're issued in a manner in which to support the multi-employer health plans into the future without coming back to the legislature to specifically say that we may not be in session when that occurs. If we are, of course, we'll take a deeper look at it and make sure that it all works. Section 16 is the effective dates. That, members, briefly, is the bill before you. I don't know how the chair wishes to handle this. I know there's a number of testifiers. I'm certain there's a number of questions. I'm guessing there's a handful of amendments. I'll leave it to the chair for which order we do these in.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Lori. Maybe I would allow members of the committee not to, we don't want to dig in right at this point, but if there's a clarifying question on what you just heard for content rather than debate of the content, I would allow some clarifying questions right now from the members. Senator Nino?
Just one quickly, and I may have misheard Senator Lori, but I thought in your overview of the bill you had said that there's legislative oversight of the fees. The bill that I read reads opposite. I just was wondering if I misheard what you said or if you misspoke.
Madam Chair, Senator Nienau, there's legislative over the salaries that will be paid to the administrative staff will come back. We'll go through the Legislative Coordinating Commission and come back to the legislature. The legislature, in the current construct of the financing mechanism, the board is authorized of its own to impose a withhold of up to 3.5% that is not slated to come back before the legislature. If I misspoke on that, was it unintentional?
Does that answer your question? Thank you. Any other clarifying questions of what you just heard? Okay, great. Thank you. Then, Senator Lori, I think there are several people who would like to speak to your bill. And is this the first person to present is Catherine Commit. Commit. Would you please introduce yourself to the committee, and we look forward to your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. My name is Catherine Commit, representing the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and we've been working very closely with Senator Lori and appreciate all of the hard work he has put into this important legislation. The Council of Health Plans has always supported universal coverage for Minnesotans. In addition, we support the creation of a state-based health insurance exchange that works for Minnesota, but we have several key concerns with the current language in the bill. First, a major concern is the language that gives the board the authority to decide which health insurance plans can be offered in the exchange. Put simply, this is the government picking winners and losers in the private marketplace. We oppose this language. The federal law requires a whole host of new processes and quality metrics that a plan must meet to be considered a qualified health plan. The criteria for participating in an exchange should be objective and based on criteria set by the federal law and the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Furthermore, if the goal is to maximize choice and competition, which consumers and employers want, then the exchange should be an open marketplace. The language in this bill limits consumer choice. Our question to you is, if a health plan is able to meet these high standards, then why wouldn't it be allowed to participate in the exchange? A competitive marketplace must entice both sellers and buyers to participate. The bill discourages interested qualified insurers from wanting to participate. The current bill language will not encourage a competitive marketplace, and it won't give all the best health insurance options to consumers who want or need to buy insurance through the exchange. Second, we are concerned about the high cost of operating the exchange and how the exchange will be funded. The federal law requires that the health insurance sold in the exchange must cover a benefit package that is more comprehensive and more expensive than the benefit package many people have today. The federal law also requires the health insurance to reduce cost sharing, the deductibles and copays, for the insured by having lower deductibles and lower copayments. The days of someone having lower health insurance premiums because they bought a high deductible, high copay plan are disappearing. The federal law will no longer allow it. As a result, these new federal requirements will increase the cost of coverage, making products more expensive than they are today. Currently, many people who have health insurance through the small group market have policies with deductibles ranging from $2,000 to $10,000. After 2014, the federal law restricts these deductibles to much lower levels, making insurance products more expensive. The state hired two consultants, Jonathan Gruber, a health economist, and Bella Gorman, a health actuary, to analyze the impact of the health care reform law on the Minnesota market. Gruber and Gorman estimated that the impact of the requirements of the federal law may increase premiums in the individual market in a range from 26 to 46%. That's a 26 to 46% increase they are estimating. Gruber and Gorman estimated premium increases in the small group market to vary even more, from a range of negative 22% to a positive 28.5%. Keep in mind, these are the premium impacts before either the federal or state premium taxes and assessments are added. New federal and state taxes will add to the cost of the premiums even more. Although the federal law will provide tax subsidies to help lower-income individuals purchase coverage, we know that many of these people do not purchase coverage today. So for these people in the exchange, having to pay for health insurance coverage will be a huge new monthly expense. In addition to the premium impacts detailed by Gruber and Gorman, is the added cost of financing the operations of the exchange. This bill requires a 3.5% premium withhold, or a premium tax, which will be added to the cost of the health insurance sold through the exchange. We strongly oppose this tax because it falls disproportionately on the fully insured market. In other words, the majority of our population who receive health insurance through a self-insured plan like CGIP, the State Employee Group Insurance Plan, or from any of our larger employers will not pay for the cost of the exchange. We view the exchange as a public good for the benefit of the entire state. Therefore, it should be funded using a broad-based mechanism that is fair, equitable, and accountable to the legislature. When you add the new federal taxes and the new state premium tax to the increased cost of health insurance products sold through the exchange, these products may be too expensive for individuals and small employer groups. If health insurance sold through the exchange is unaffordable, even with the federal tax subsidies, then we could actually end up with more uninsured Minnesotans, not fewer. The exchange staff has testified that the budget to build the exchange is $165 million. This is an expense of $165 million before $1 is spent on providing health care to those purchasing insurance through the exchange. The exchange staff has also testified that the annual cost to operate the exchange will be about $62 million. This is a significant cost that will be borne by those purchasing health insurance through the exchange. As the legislature determines a broad-based, fair, and accountable funding source for the exchange, we would also urge them to do a thorough review of the exchange budget. Third, we have concerns with the bill relating to the composition of the board of directors and the conflict of interest language. Federal regulations expressly state that the exchange board must ensure that a majority of the board members have relevant experience in the areas of health insurance benefits, healthcare finance, health plan purchasing, healthcare delivery systems, etc. However, as written, Senate File 1 does not require board members to have relevant experience as required by law. Members of the Governor's Health Insurance Exchange Advisory Task Force are also concerned that this language excludes individuals with current relevant experience from serving on the board. Minnesota's nonprofit health plans have a great deal of experience providing health insurance coverage to Minnesotans. As nonprofits, each health plan has a mission to most effectively cover the health needs of the populations they serve. Individually and collectively, the health plans have served the state exceptionally well. The implementation of the exchange is large in scale, affecting many parts of the health insurance industry, and it will have a significant impact on the existing marketplace and regulatory structure relating to health care insurance. As such, it would be beneficial to consumers to have members of the board who know and understand how the health insurance system works. Without that relevant experience, the board will be limited in its ability to make fully informed decisions. Finally, Madam Chair, I want to mention one more important issue, and that is making sure the exchange is ready for open enrollment on October 1st, 2013. As I said at the outset, the health plans want the exchange to work. However, getting the IT systems up and running with the health plans is an enormous and expensive undertaking, both for the state and as they create the new systems, and for the health plans to be ready to connect with these new systems. IT readiness is perhaps the biggest problem for the exchange and yet is least talked about. If the exchange can't be supported by this new IT system, it will not be operational, and this is a real possibility. As policymakers, you have an opportunity to thoroughly review this legislation and ensure that the exchange must meet the minimum requirements at the lowest cost. We urge you to avoid making the exchange overly prescriptive with limited consumer choice and so expensive that we end up with more people uninsured. We want the exchange to work for Minnesota, but as currently drafted, we cannot support the bill. For the reasons I have just mentioned, we have serious concerns that the exchange will not succeed. Nevertheless, we remain committed to working with the author on this major on our major concerns and other provisions that have been modified so that we can create an exchange that works for Minnesotans. And thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Yes, thank you. Ms. Kimmett, may I ask you just real quickly, was this just testimony given on board composition and on the other elements of this in local government or in commerce? Were these concerns presented at that time?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, these concerns were raised at the Commerce Committee hearings. And but not specifically, well, I take that back. I did not testify at the local government committee. However, my colleague did, and I believe he did briefly address this issue.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony. My request is that presentation, of course, is appropriate for that committee. But we really need to take our time here. That was well over 2 minutes. And there are others who want to testify on the issues of significance to this committee. And so I'm very serious about this, and I want to welcome certainly questions, but we have an obligation here to meet a certain portion of this bill's review. And so please keep your testimony to those issues if you come forward. And I'm expecting that you'll honor that. Kate Johansson, Beth McMullen, and Twyla Brace will be next, if you'll please come forward.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Kate Johansson. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and its 2,400 employers, 80% of which are small businesses eligible to participate in a Minnesota State Health Insurance Exchange. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in Senate File 1 and want to thank Senator Lori very much, not only for his hard work on this issue, but also his open-door policy in collaborating with stakeholders on this legislation. The Chamber has long supported the legislative creation of a state health insurance exchange that empowers consumers to make informed choices that meet their needs and resources. While we do not support the bill in its current form, we do look forward to continuing to work with anyone who is interested to improve the bill so that it achieves those goals and that this legislation represents a starting point and not an ending point, as was noted upon its introduction. Certainly, there are several salient concerns that the Chamber has, many of which were just reiterated by Ms. Kimmett on finance, governance, oversight, and accountability. But out of respect for the Chair's recent comments, I will focus my comments today primarily on the role that the Board has in selecting which products can participate in a health insurance exchange. The language that the Chamber has most concerned about starts on page 7 and is contained within subdivision 5. The policy here is simple. This creates an active purchaser exchange, and the policy that this committee is charged with evaluating is what will work for an exchange and what will be truly beneficial to consumers. The Chamber does oppose its current language because we believe that a four-person majority board should not be allowed to pick winners and losers amongst health products and plans, and that it should not decide what products consumers can access. So why is an active purchaser exchange not helpful to consumers? First, as noted, it limits choice. And consumers like choice. They benefit from choice, and they want choice. In speaking with my members, they want an opportunity to seek several different products that they can tailor in their purchasing to their individual needs and resources or to their small businesses' needs and resources. Second, an active purchaser model disincents product innovation. A plan takes months, if not years, to develop products. And if they do not have an assurance that if they meet guidelines that are developed to protect consumers, but rather could be subject to the will of a four-person majority board and excluded from a marketplace, that certainly creates a problem to developing those new products. Third, an active purchaser model dampens innovation in purchasing. One of the goals that many people have discussed both at the task force level and generally within the healthcare reform discussion over the past few years is the concept of defined contribution, letting individuals make portable healthcare purchasing choices. Without a variety of healthcare products, it is much less likely that folks will want to transform their purchasing models to defined contribution. We also hear the argument that it's necessary to limit choice because people need simpler processes to purchase health insurance. Certainly, I would not say that that's not a concern, but I would say that consumers are competent. And additionally, we have many tools to empower consumers and make that process simpler through the exchange bill that already exists and through the state's work. We've created a $41 million website. We have brokers, which a state study shows many small businesses trust their brokers as much or more than they trust their spouses, which I don't know if that's a commentary on spouses or brokers. But finally, we also have navigators. So there are many tools to aid in the simplification of purchasing health insurance for those who do not feel currently competent to do so. And finally, I would say, what would the chamber solution be? We would suggest that an any willing plan model is preferable to the model contained in the bill currently. This would allow for a robust market outside the exchange, and it would ensure that criteria set both by federal and state governments, criteria for plan certification that already are designed to protect consumers, would make sure that plans develop products that are protecting consumers, but that once they do so, they are allowed to access market and provide consumers the choice from which they so well benefit. Ultimately, the Chamber is committed to finding an insurance exchange that will work, but we are on a tight timeline, and we do not need to address this controversial issue at this time. The federal government does not require an active purchaser model. Indeed, other states that have marketplace facilitating models or any willing plan models would receive conditional approval. We humbly respect and suggest that you focus on functionality, avoiding the dangers of overreach, and please consider amending this to reflect an any willing plan model instead of an active purchaser model. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Beth McMullen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth McMullen, and I represent the Minnesota Business Partnership. We're an association of CEOs of Minnesota's largest employers, and our members employ over 400,000 Minnesotans in the state. I was a little repetitive there. While the companies I represent are generally self-insured in terms of health employee benefits and are too large to purchase through the exchange, we are interested in creating an exchange that will add value to the healthcare system in Minnesota. I appreciate Senator Lori continuing with us on conversations on how we can make this bill a better piece of legislation for all. As the chamber, the partnership has supported the creation of a Minnesota-based exchange from the passage of the ACA, and we continue to hope that we can create an exchange for Minnesota. What we really would like to see in an exchange is a market-based system that will deliver exceptional value to consumers in both in terms of cost as well as quality and choice, and will meet the tight timelines of implementation. With respect to the committee's time, I'm not going to reiterate the points that Ms. Johansson has just made, and we would share her same concerns. I would also just like to take a moment, though, to say in some of the committees, it hasn't come up yet, but in some of the committees we've heard testimony on this active purchaser model that's contained in the bill, and comparing it to the ability to negotiate for better rates like large employers do. As a representative of large employers, I just feel it's really important to point out the key difference. Large employers self-fund their health benefits for their employees. There is no insurance. They hold the risk for the employee benefits that they provide to their employees. Employees don't necessarily see it. They might see an insurance card like a small group market would, and I point to myself because I'm actually, my employer purchases through the small group market. So they might have an insurance card that looks like ours, but it is fully funded by their employer. There is no insurance. The employer holds the risk. And that's key because in terms of ability to negotiate, the exchange will still, if it is able to do that, which I'm not certain that it actually has the ability to negotiate on price, it is different than what a large employer does. Large employers have flexibility to design benefits that they think will attract and retain their employees. They have cost share mechanisms that they think will work for their employees. They do other things that help hold down the cost of medical costs for their employees, like wellness and so forth, that the exchange will not be able to offer for its people purchasing through the exchange. And so that's just kind of a quick overview of some of the differences that I see between what large employers do through self-funded and what people do through fully insured market. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. McMullen. Ms. Breeze.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members
of the committee. Before you begin, maybe I could ask Audrey Britton, and is it Danny Watson or Daniel? Danny Watson. And Todd Mickelson is also with that group. Excuse me.
That's fine. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and I know that you have limited sections of the bill that you are asking for testimony on today. I would just like to start by saying that we don't agree with the name of the bill, it being a Minnesota insurance marketplace. We would just like to let you know that in our estimation, what this really is an IT superstructure connecting the state of Minnesota through IT online internet connections. It has a federal website. And in the contract, it's actually called the Federal MnHICS. So it's acknowledged in the state contract that it is a federal website. So it's the federal website, the IT connections to the federal hub, and then a board to make decisions, to sign the contracts, to manage the IT connections, and to make decisions about who will be allowed to sell health insurance on the website, on the federal website. So when I look at the bill, if you go to Section 5, which is on 2.29, but beginning on 2.31, Subdivision 1, creation. So it says that the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace is created as a board, and the first thing it says that it is to do is to promote innovation, competition, quality, value, market participation, affordability, meaningful choices, health improvement, care management, reduction of health disparities, and portability of health plans. Now, when we look at that definition, I know that in judiciary there was an amendment to take out that language, but Senator Lori called it substantive and didn't want it to be removed, and so it still remains in here. But when we look at that language, what we see and note is that this is really not all just about insurance, but this is actually about delving into the patient-doctor relationship, delving into what happens in the clinic, what happens in the hospital. When the Commerce Committee tried to take out those words, health improvement, care management, that entire section, the author mentioned that this was all about population health. So clearly this is not just about selling health insurance. It's also about being over and overseeing the entire medical delivery system that we have. So it's about getting in the middle between the patient and the doctor, and that concerns our organization. Now, when we look at how the health plans are going to be selected through the active purchaser model versus a clearinghouse, we're also concerned about that because if you put all these things together, if you look at this as a federal website and you realize that it's going to be following the federal law and the federal rules as compared to the state ones, and then you see this language that I have just laid out, plus you add onto it the active purchaser model, which means that this board of seven individuals with only four of them needed for any decision, so the consumers could all be out of there. Everything that the consumers want could just be voted away. So when you see that, then I look at it and I go, is this potentially a rationing plan? Because if what we're going to get is a select group of health plans, then what's going to happen in the negotiation between the board and the plans, when you look at the fact that they're going to do health improvement, care management, et cetera, we wonder if that means that the only plans that are going to get into it are those that are going to agree to do health care the way the board wants health care done and not the way that's good for the individual. So we look at it here as a potential way of actually rationing health care through the limitation of health plans. The other thing I wanted to mention about the language of manageable choices. You know, this whole idea of limiting our choices into what somebody thinks is manageable is a great concern of ours, because whatever I might choose for anything might not be what you would choose for something. So manageable choices means limiting choices to some other outsider's idea of what a good choice is. And I would just say that this is not the first time that this state has done this, but we've never agreed to it when it's done it before. Because with the Rule 101 language and that requirement in statute, that actually tells doctors that they can't participate unless they take 20% of Medicaid, and it forces them into health plans and then forces them to do whatever health plans want them to do. So there are different levels here that we're concerned about having to do with the potential for rationing of care by the limiting of health plans.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Audrey Britton.
Yep. Well, Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your time today for hearing this testimony. My name is Audrey Britton. I'm a public affairs director, chair for Small Business Minnesota, and I'm also a small business owner. I'm here today to provide testimony on behalf of the Small Business Minnesota Board of Directors. Small Business Minnesota is a nonprofit, nonpartisan association. All of our members are small business owners. Our mission is to use fact-based information to voice the true needs of small businesses in Minnesota in the public policy arena, among other services. With the exception of a part-time administrative assistant, we are an all-volunteer organization. Our members are from manufacturing, engineering, business growth consulting, electronic nautical equipment, M&A consulting, and I could go on. They are Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Libertarians, and more. But as small business owners, we have many things in common and share many of the same concerns. Small Business Minnesota formed because, to be quite candid, we have grown tired of the voices speaking on behalf of small businesses that sometimes distort the facts and even more often exclude the voice of small business owners. We are also weary of interests that claim to represent small businesses when, at times, they do not. Being affiliated with small business is currently very popular, yet we often feel like the poster child that no one wants to hear from. Minnesota small businesses are Minnesota's number one job creator. We are the largest employer in the state. And even though Minnesota has created a business environment that has attracted more Fortune 500 companies per capita than any other state, it is rarely noted that Minnesota's small businesses employ more people than all the state's Fortune 500s combined. According to the latest available U.S. Census data, Minnesota has almost half a million employers, including those who are self-employed. 98% of all Minnesota businesses are small businesses, according to the Small Business Administration, which is a government agency that compiles statistics like this. 96% of businesses have 100 or fewer employees. 86% of businesses, in fact, employ fewer than 20 people. So according to statistics compiled again by the SBA, and contrary to common belief, the vast majority of small business owners take home less than $100,000 a year. This means that very few small business owners, if any, can afford a lobbyist, and most are very busy running their business and cannot walk away from their work responsibilities to spend days at the Capitol. Small business truly is the silent majority. While there have been very effective voices for big businesses in Minnesota, there has yet to be an effective voice for small business. And Small Business Minnesota's mission is to augment the voice of business owners. As mentioned earlier, our only members include business owners. So we are in favor of the active purchaser agreement. Small Business Minnesota conducted a member survey last fall, and our members stated that affordable health care was their top priority. Small Business Minnesota strongly supports the provision in the exchange that allows the state to negotiate group rates or be an active purchaser. As mentioned before, because the majority of small businesses employ less than 20 people, access to group rates is extremely limited and therefore the cost prohibitively high for these small business owners and their employees. This means that Minnesota's largest job creator frequently does not have access to group rates and frequently cannot afford to offer health insurance. There exists a real need to negotiate a true group-rated health insurance for small businesses. And even though small businesses are the largest job creators, we are unable to place our large number of employees into a collective pool that drives down health insurance costs. As one Small Business Minnesota member told me, insurance companies claim they give a group rate, but they are really just rating us as individuals, and underwriting allows them to raise the small group rate. And that member is an insurance agent who sells health insurance. We heard testimony from a small business owner last week who said he spends 15% to 20% of his profits, which is also known for most small business owners as take-home pay, on health care. This is a common story among small business owners. It does not reflect at all what happens in big corporations. Negotiating with insurers for lower cost and better quality coverage is commonplace in the insurance market, or being able to maintain your own risk. Large employers can do that. Large employers negotiate with insurers on their behalf. State agencies negotiate with insurers over public health care coverage. Small business employers need the exchange to negotiate for better prices and benefits for them and their employees. This is about leveling the playing field. Small businesses cannot continue paying more than what large businesses pay for the same coverage, particularly since small businesses play such an integral part to our state economy. Any business owner knows that attracting and retaining talent is key to success, and that cost of turnover is very high. Small business owners have told us that they have trouble attracting and retaining top talent because, as small business owners, they cannot compete with the health care packages offered by big business. An owner of a small engineering company told me that he lost an employee because she was planning to start a family and needed to work where there was better maternity coverage. An owner of a graphic design company said she can no longer offer health benefits and understands the disadvantage this creates as they are in the process of hiring more employees. This also means that she and her own family have minimum coverage and recently sat around the dinner table discussing if they could afford an MRI for their daughter. I recently met with a small business owner who is getting ready to hire employees. She will not be able to offer coverage at all. She's also a single mom. I asked her what she does for health insurance, and she says right now she doesn't have any. Now, with respect to time, I understand you don't want comments on the overseeing board, but I do want to let you know that Small Business Minnesota agrees with the conflict of interest statements as they are currently in the bill, and we definitely agree, of course, with the provision that requires a small business owner to be part of that board. I will say that we want to make sure that that small business owner truly represents the small businesses of Minnesota and is not someone who's been in contact or part of organizations that truly actually represent large businesses. So in summary, Small Business Minnesota is Minnesota's largest employer, number one job creator, yet true group rates and negotiating power are not available to small businesses. Healthcare costs are often or are already prohibitively high for both small business owners and their employees. Being unable to offer healthcare benefit that competes with large businesses puts small businesses at a severe disadvantage when trying to attract and retain talent. And therefore, we support Minnesota being an active purchaser. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Rosen, did you have a question for the testifier?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name. But Small Business Minnesota, I'm sorry, what is your name?
Audrey Britton.
Britton. Okay, thank you. How many members do you have in your Small Business Minnesota organization, Ms. Britton?
We're an all-volunteer organization. We just started organizing over the past 12 months. Last time I testified, I said we had 100 members. I just talked to the person who keeps all of our data, and we're up to over 200 business owners. So that, of course, constricts how many members we can have. and now we're over 200 people. If you're asking for what constitutes a statistically valid sampling of business owners, I don't have that information. If you do, I'd love to know. My understanding is the chamber represents, for example, less than 0.5% of all the businesses in Minnesota. I'm not sure if that was your question, but I wanted to make sure I was answering it.
Thank you, Ms. Britton. Madam Chair.
Another question?
Yes. Just a comment. I was just going to say NFIB has got 13,000 members, and so this 200 is a direct contradiction to what we're hearing from the small business community already.
I'm sorry. You know, I don't understand the... So we're Small Business Minnesota. We
Madam Chair.
Just started our organization a year ago. We've got 200 members. If we keep at this rate, we'll have thousands of members compared to organizations that have been around for 100 years or more. So I'm sorry, I'm not understanding what the comparison is of our organization to other organizations.
Senator Rosen?
Madam Chair, I guess I have the ability to make a comment without another comment being made. I guess for a small business owner, perhaps you start at 100 and you went to 200, but I think 13,000 small business voices is pretty strong. And so
thank you, Senator Rosen. Let's see. We're moving now to
Danny
Watson. Danny Watson. Thank you, Danny. And Todd Mickelson. This is Todd. Yes, hi, Todd. As you can see, people are having trouble with time. So I'm really making an appeal that you make your critical points as quickly as you can. We want to get into the crux of what we need to talk about in this committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I thank you for taking the time to hear my testimony. My name is Danny Watson. I'm a small business owner, and like 65% of businesses in Minnesota, I'm a one-person shop. I'm a marketing consultant, and my employees, if you will, are other freelancers who bring high-level expertise to projects. Because it is relevant to my testimony, I will also tell you that I do a lot of work in health promotion and approaches to reducing healthcare costs. I develop evidence-based marketing strategies to influence healthy lifestyle choices, such as persuading diabetics to take classes in how to manage their disease. Today, I'm here to support the active purchaser provision, and I'll skip the others. And most importantly, want to draw your attention to how these provisions help promote a healthier future for all Minnesotans. The Minnesota Department of Health lists small business development as a core indicator of future health outcomes in Minnesota, along with indicators such as prenatal care, per capita income, and on-time high school completion. Indeed, our state is now developing our Healthy Minnesota 2020 Action Plan based on the most current public health research available. One of the draft plan's top three priorities is to strengthen communities to create their own healthy futures. It specifically indicates that Minnesota's attention to small business development will drive improved health outcomes in the future by reducing health disparities, creating more employment success for more people, and encouraging stable, more cohesive communities. The science linking strong local economies to improved health outcomes is part of what is called the social determinants of health, which show that education, location, and income and other factors have a profound effect on health. I have printed copies of my statement and will direct you to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for more information on the social determinants of health. My point is that small businesses need access to affordable health insurance for the health of their employees, the economic health of their communities, and the future health of all Minnesotans. And because access to affordable health insurance is so important for small businesses, I come here today to support the active purchaser provision in the proposed legislation. Small businesses are Minnesota's number one job creator, and without this provision, a large segment of Minnesota's workforce will not have access to true group rate pricing. Personally, I was not able to afford to pay a living wage and offer health insurance through my small company when I did have employees, and I couldn't have stayed in business for 19 years had I not had coverage through my husband's employer. This is true of many people in my circle of colleagues. Access to affordable health insurance is a key factor in deciding whether to start or continue a small business. In closing, please remember that the decisions this committee makes will not only affect the ability of small businesses and entrepreneurs to buy affordable health insurance, they will affect our ability as a state to build strong communities that promote improved health outcomes for all Minnesotans. Thank you very kindly for your time and attention.
Thank you. Mr. Mickelson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for allowing me to speak today. My name is Todd Mickelson, and I own a small business I built around a patented invention of mine. And we assemble that and other items I've developed out of the old Tonka Toys building on Lake Minnetonka, and we sell items all around the world. I'm here because I am a true small business owner and disagree with a lot of the voices that claim to be the voice for small business. You may have seen an article in last week's Sunday's Star and Tribune business section that I was featured in, and I talk about the troubles that we as a small business have had securing small loans and credit, and that we feel as though we've been penalized just for being a small business. We also feel like we're in the penalty box when it comes to the subject of health care. Being small business owners, we must secure our own health care coverage. My wife and business partner, Heidi, spends a fair amount of time managing this. She, my 9-year-old daughter Eve, and I are pretty healthy people. We take pretty good care of ourselves and very seldom need to see the doctor. I had an incident last summer where I had a rash on my leg that I had decided was definitely going to kill me by the end of the weekend. So I went to urgent care. It turned out to be poison ivy. And I had to pay for that trip out of my own pocket. Dental coverage is prohibitively expensive for us, so all of our dental costs are out of our own pocket. And if our daughter were to break her arm, we'd have to take out a small loan just to pay the high deductibles. So even though we are paying hundreds of dollars a month, it feels as though we have no health insurance at all. So my wife, Heidi, continues to constantly be on the lookout for a better deal for our insurance, spending a fair amount of time at it, taking away from time we can spend on our small business. Again, another penalty to small business owners. Now we're faced with the possibility of growing our small business, and you'd think this would be a good thing, and it is, and it's in our plan for the next few years. But like other small business owners, we're waiting to see if providing employees with health insurance is even going to be possible. So we're very excited about the changes being made. I'm here in full support of Senator Lurie's bill the way it is. Heidi's looking very forward to an exchange where she can easily compare health care plans, and we very much hope that the Minnesota health care exchange bills continue and pass with the provisions that allow the state to negotiate group rates. This would greatly encourage us to more vigorously pursue our plans to grow our business and create more jobs. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak today.
Thank you, Mr. Mickelson. Chris Schneeman?
John Borovich.
Excuse me, your name is?
John Borovich. I'm a small business owner.
Did I call you forward from the list?
No, you were just coming part of
okay.
this group.
Thank you very much. This is part of Chris Schneeman's group?
No.
Nope. Oh, you were part of the small business?
Yes.
Group. I'm sorry. Your name wasn't on our list. I wasn't following this.
I'll be very quick.
I hope you keep your comments to very, very minimal.
We both go. Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is John Borovich. I'm a small business owner, very small business. I have 6 employees. I've been an entrepreneur all my life in the state of Minnesota. And basically, the problem we've had in startups and in ongoing businesses in which I now run is that there's an access problem to true group rated health insurance. You've heard that. It is an impediment to small businesses, especially smaller ones under 20 employees. We need to take this action, and so I'm here to fully support Senator Lurie's bill. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Did we get your name? Be sure to sign in so we have your name. Thank you. Chris Schneeman?
I'm Craig Britton. I'm also part of this group.
You know, I'm sorry. I think I'm going to have to ask you to wait to come to the end. We had a couple of people whose names were on here to present this message, and there are others
because your names are not on the list, I'm just, are you all a part of the small business group?
I'm the last one.
If you can keep it to under 30 seconds, we'll go with it. But
I'm Craig Britton, and I'm a small business owner. I'm a growth expert. I consult with other businesses on how to grow their business. I've also been the chief marketing officer for two Fortune 500 insurance companies. I'm here to advocate for the active purchaser part of the exchange bill. Insurance companies' greatest fear is that groups, large groups, will negotiate with them. They have been ineffective at reducing health care. This is why large companies do not use insurance companies. They self-insure. The cost of my insurance personally is $13,000 a year. With my wife, it approaches $20,000. That's because I cannot negotiate as part of a group. I highly, highly encourage you to keep the active purchaser. If you also look at the science of choice, too much choice is counterproductive to consumer benefit. So this is nonsense about having enough choice. The issue is too much choice.
Thank you. And if you did not sign in, I'd appreciate it if you would do that.
Sure.
Have I found Chris Schneeman as of yet?
I'm glad to be here.
Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Schneeman. I will also ask Alfred Johnson, Babington Johnson, and Rick Varco to approach the table so that we can go with your testimony in a timely way.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, Senator Lurie. My name is Chris Schneeman. I own an independent insurance agency with 10 employees here in downtown St. Paul called Seven Hills Benefit Partners. There we assist and advocate for over 200 small employers out of our agency and several thousand individuals, and we help them manage their health insurance purchasing decisions. I am here today, however, to represent the Agents Coalition for Healthcare Reform, which is comprised of the four professional insurance agent associations operating in Minnesota, which includes the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, the professional insurance agents, and the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers. Collectively, we represent over 54,000 Minnesota licensed professional agents and their employees. And we work closely with both group health insurance and individual market consumers on a regular basis. Agents have supported and continue to encourage an insurance exchange that supports our unique Minnesota healthcare system and its competitive insurance market. Our members have spent countless hours participating over the past year in Governor Dayton's health insurance exchange task force and the many working groups that were part of that. I'd like to start off first by thanking Senator Lurie for working with us to revise the portion of the bill that addresses agent regulation and working with us to find workable language on other important issues that impact how the exchange and agents interact in their roles in serving Minnesotans. We do have a few remaining concerns with the bill and continue to work with Senator Lurie to address them, and we greatly appreciate his willingness and open-door policy as he hears out our concerns. First, we're concerned about the lack of oversight in the bill and the amount of control over the insurance marketplace in the hands of a few unelected persons. While there is minimal amount of audit oversight, there is no mechanism for the legislature to approve the budget of the exchange. I will skip a couple of my other points here in the interest of time. I do want to say that we do have concerns about the types of products that might be made available on the exchange, and we'd like to see those limited to those specifically required by the Affordable Care Act, which is adult dental products and that sort of thing. So ultimately, we'd almost like to see a prohibition on products other than health insurance and pediatric dental to be included in the bill. But mostly, and you've heard active purchaser quite a bit today, our most serious concern remains with the active purchaser model. As representatives of both individual and group insurance consumers, many of them, We do not believe that the market will continue or will welcome an exchange board with just a four-person majority to decide which products are best for the entire state of Minnesota. This is contrary to an exchange encouraging a competitive marketplace, but rather limits product offerings, discourages innovation, competition, and choice. In effect, would you like to have someone do this, make these decisions for you with regard to your wardrobe? Probably not. Insurance needs and people are diverse and cannot be well served by a limited offering of products that don't meet the scope of needs and preferences of all Minnesotans. President Obama, in passing the Affordable Care Act, spoke often about choice and competition. We agree with that statement and feel the exchange needs to maximize choice and competition. We need to encourage you to amend the bill to allow for an open market, because only in an open market that accepts any willing health plan will consumers be able to find affordable health insurance to meet their diverse needs. Now, I also want to bring some additional information, and I'm happy to submit it to the committee for your record. There's been comments heard over and over again that small employers are somehow disadvantaged. In Minnesota, in 1992, the legislature enacted some landmark health insurance reforms called Minnesota Care. That was many years ago, several decades ago. When that happened, small employers were given tremendous market power because all products were made guaranteed available to them, and the price of that product was limited within a certain range of opportunity for carriers. So since 1992, we have had an open, accessible marketplace for small employers, right? So I'd like to discount some of the previous testimony. The other is that small employers pay more. We want facts, so I'm just going to give you some facts. And this comes from a United Benefit Advisors national survey of over 17,000 plans, the largest health insurance survey done in the country. What it tells us is that if you're an employer with more than 1,000 employees, your annual cost per employee per year is $9,177. If you're an employer with between 100 and 200 employees, smaller, your cost is $9,124. If you're an employer with fewer than 25 employees, I guess we'd call that a small employer, your annual cost per employee per year is $8,427. The math doesn't support the rhetoric. Small employers buy health care and get the same price for a heart transplant that somebody who works at 3M does. The cost of insurance is driven by the cost of care, not by how big you are, right? So I think it's important to get that myth out there and start working on reform so that it reduces costs for everybody. I appreciate your time, Madam Chair and Senators, and we'll be sticking around for questions later. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schneeman. Let's see. Alfred Bevington Johnson.
Thank you. Chairperson Sharon and members of the Minnesota Senate Health, Human Services, and Housing Policy Committee. My name is Alfred Bevington Johnson. I'm the founder of the Stairstep Initiative, which works to create a model of community. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to testify. I was pleased to serve on the governor's task force on the insurance exchange. We invested significant time, thought, and energy into providing suggestions for the framing and the operation of the insurance exchange. I'm appreciative of the work Senator Lowry did in crafting Senate File 1 and fully support the establishment of the Minnesota Insurance Exchange. The structuring of the personal assister and the navigator functions are critical to the operation of a successful exchange and are the focus of my remarks today. The Affordable Care Act has a lofty goal and a powerful strategy connected to the achievement of that goal, the goal to dramatically reduce the cost curve of health care in America, and the powerful strategy to expand health insurance coverage to all Americans. In considering the best implementation approach for Minnesota, the first action we took as a task force was to acknowledge the importance of viewing all decisions in respect to their impact on the issue of health disparities. This came after discussion and analysis brought us to recognize that health disparities exacerbate the rising cost of health care. It's projected in the 10-year period from 2010 to 2018, disparities will produce an additional $337 billion in cost to the healthcare system. The The key connection of these facts to our discussion today is that the uninsured represent a critical aspect of the widening health disparities and increased costs. The uninsured population of Minnesota stands at a solid 9%. These have not been brought under the tent of coverage by the traditional methods used by our broker-provider network. The personal assister and navigator component of the insurance exchange should be laser-focused on the outreach, education, and then enrollment of this 9% of our population that are uninsured and have not been connected by the current measures. Just as brokers have established what we've heard often as a vital trust relationship with individuals and small businesses that have embraced the culture of insurance, many of the uninsured and the underinsured have ongoing relationships with community agencies and institutions that are in regular contact with them and provide valuable services for them and with whom trust relationships exist. If we are to be successful in defeating both the rising cost of health care and improving the overall health of our citizens, then the Minnesota Exchange will need all hands on deck, each fulfilling their most effective roles to support our best outcomes. Senators, I implore you to maximize the ability to engage the uninsured by using the leverage of community agencies and institutions to reach, educate, and to enroll. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Rick Barkle, Mary Jo George, and Arnie Anderson can approach the table.
Chair Sharon, members of the committee, my name is Rick Varko. I'm the political director with SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. We represent about 15,000 healthcare workers around the state in hospitals, nursing homes, and clinics. I think it's important to remember those for whom this bill is too late. One of those people was the son of an SEIU member. He was diagnosed with cancer. His very difficult chemotherapy forced him to quit his job. And, of course, without a job, he soon lost his health insurance. Without insurance, cancer took not just his home and his savings, it took his peace of mind and his dignity. Towards the end, he was told that if he wanted his chemo, he better bring cash to the hospital. With an exchange, he would have been able to buy insurance without being screened for a pre-existing condition. Without income, he would have been subsidized and thus able to afford health care. That's why we're doing this today. I want to emphasize the importance of the Exchange Board's ability to negotiate with health plans in order to get lower prices and better coverage. No matter how many different plans and different insurers are available within the exchange, if the Exchange Board cannot negotiate with the plans, then the option of lower cost, better quality plans will be off the table for all individual consumers. By negotiating with insurers, the Exchange Board creates new options for consumers, lower cost, better quality options that would not otherwise be available. The Exchange Board should have the same power to negotiate for lower costs that Walmart or any other large-scale purchaser is able to get. We've got evidence of this here in Minnesota. When the Medicaid managed care contracts were open for competitive bidding, it saved Minnesota $175 million in fiscal year 12-13. The Any Willing Health Plan system diverts public money to insurance companies while real competition delivers better care at lower prices. Allowing the exchange to selectively contract simply allows it to exercise its power like any other free market actor. It has no power to compel any plan to offer insurance for sale. The insurance plans express great fear that with selective contracting, they are not guaranteed that their product will be offered. First, I think this fear is overblown. The Massachusetts Connector, which is an active purchaser, has not rejected any qualified plan so far in several years of operation. But second, since when does the free market guarantee that every seller gets a buyer? Free markets presume buyers can reject initial offers and look for a better deal. Free markets presume that every agent will seek out the best deal for itself and the customers it represents. If the legislature prevents the Exchange Board from acting the same way any smart business would, you're not preserving a free market. You're rigging the market to protect the interest of health plans and insurance companies. Thank you.
Thank you. Mary Jo George, Arnie Anderson, and John Woodwick.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Mary Jo George.
With Thank you, Mary Jo. As you're coming up, I don't know if all of you have been here all the time, but we have asked that you stay focused on the critical issues in front of this committee and to restrict your comments to those things. And if you're going to repeat things that others have said, I'd appreciate it if you simply say that we confirm and affirm these positions rather than go into detail.
We appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 1, and we'd like to thank Senator Lurie for his leadership in bringing this legislation forward. As many of you know, AARP represents nearly 700,000 members statewide, 44% of whom are between the ages of 50 and 64. For many of our members in this age group, finding access to affordable health care has been challenging. Thus, AARP is very interested in the creation of a consumer-friendly health insurance exchange to provide access to quality, affordable coverage consumers need. Overall, AARP believes the exchange should ensure that all policy and operational choices should be considered through the lens of the consumer. We also believe consumers will best be served by the creation of an exchange that is large enough to alter the insurance market and strong enough to foster active negotiation with the plans. This is the same approach that large employers use to attain maximum benefits at affordable rates, but it's also the same approach used by the Veterans Administration to negotiate lower drug prices. Today, Medicare does not have that authority, and as a result, spends an estimated $100 billion more a year on drug prices than the Veterans Administration. We're urging lawmakers, let's not make that same mistake as we develop our own state-based run exchange. Also, a public opinion poll that we conducted last year showed broad support for this authority to negotiate on behalf of consumers, and I do have a handout, Madam Chair, for the committee of our poll results. While AARP supports a robust exchange with competing plans, we also support the language in the bill that allows the exchange to select and offer a manageable number of affordable quality products. We are concerned that too many plans will make it difficult for consumers to easily compare plans and make meaningful choices. Lastly, with regard to education and outreach, AARP wants consumers to have clear, objective information about their health plan choices. They also want information from a variety of sources. Therefore, we support language in the bill that envisions a role both for brokers and navigators. We believe navigators will play a key role in reaching out to diverse groups that may be harder to reach due to cultural, language barriers, as well as a lack of familiarity without insurance. In conclusion, a strong outreach program combined with the authority for the exchange to negotiate on behalf of consumers will ensure that the Minnesota Exchange works in the best interest of consumers. Thank you.
Thank you. Arnie Anderson.
Madam Chair and Senators, my name is Arnie Anderson. I'm the director of the statewide association, the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. I have two very brief comments. First, it's clear that the implementation of the health insurance exchange is very complex. We support giving the new exchange as much flexibility as possible so they can be as successful as possible. More specifically, we support the flexible language in Senate File 1 on page 8 regarding navigators and in-person assisters. Second, as they say, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Correctly, we are working hard to provide more one-stop experience for small businesses who need services from government. We should be doing the same thing with services for low-income Minnesotans. We will be missing a tremendous opportunity to be customer-friendly if the health exchange were to be implemented as a single-purpose categorical program. And with that, it's my pleasure to introduce to you Mr. John Woodwick, who is the Executive Director of the Minnesota Valley Action Council in Mankato, serving the 9 counties in south-central Minnesota.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Woodwick.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We are speaking on behalf of the navigators and the assisters, and there was a handout that was provided to each of you that just illustrates that point about what goes on in the 9 counties of south central Minnesota, but this would be true throughout the state of Minnesota. how community action agencies approach working with people that are experiencing low wage or low income. What we heard earlier about the Robert Woods Foundation and what they are bringing people together around, that whole idea about health, that it's not merely about health insurance, but it's about the entire view of what it takes to be healthy. That's good food, that's good housing, that's heated homes. If any of those things suffer, then your health, your physical health, won't improve. So the Federal Reserve called a group of interested members around last November to talk about that issue and expand what we think of as far as healthy communities. That illustration that you have before you about the people are stopping in the 9 county offices within South Central Minnesota, we keep track of what they're asking us for, whether we can help them directly or whether we can turn them to the right location. And you can see that I have every month across the top, there's a cumulative total identified in yellow for 2012. And then at the bottom, there is a medical dental that tells you those numbers of, again, people making those inquiries just within South Central Minnesota. So we look at the entire individual and try to impact that. We think that we do navigation. We think that we do that assist people. So that's all my comments. Thank you.
Thank you. It's noticeable, the big jump in 2012.
Yes.
And anticipated, I guess, 2011. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Woodwick. Appreciate you coming up from Mankato.
Sure. Great relatives.
Marie Ellis, Steve Ellen, and Elaine Cunningham. Oh, excuse me, Jonathan Watson. I skipped over you. I didn't mean to do that. Jonathan Watson, Marie Ellis, Steve Ellen. And then Elaine, if you would be prepared to come when Jonathan is finished.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Jonathan Watson. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. We represent the 17 federally qualified health centers in the state. We provide care to 185,000 folks, behavioral health, medical care, and dental services. 95% of our patients are below 200% of poverty, so clearly they're going to be the heavy users of the exchange, if you will. In particular, about 70,000 of those folks are uninsured. They're going to be interfacing with the exchange as it moves forward. I just have two quick comments on the bill today. The first, I think, has been echoed before in terms of the personal assisters and navigators. I think Senator Lori did a great job in his overview of the bill talking about these, the functions being outreach, enrollment in a linguistically appropriate manner. That really describes what community health centers have been doing for 40 years. We just didn't know there was a technical term for it. Nonetheless, we've been doing that for our low-income populations. Because we really realize there's a finite resources out there for the uninsured, and it's in our best interest and the patient's best interest to get folks enrolled into programs as they're eligible. Just had a conversation this morning with United Family Medicine in St. Paul, and they do every uninsured woman over the age of 40 that presents at the front desk, they do actively work with them, screen them for programs they're eligible for, particularly the SAGE program, which is breast and cervical cancer screening. So we're just very supportive of what is in the bill for that. In my conversations with Senator Lori in the fiscal note, there appears to be some financial funding to support these activities, and community health centers stand at the ready to participate. The second piece is something that works well in current statute, and you probably don't hear that a lot over here at the legislature, but it is the Essential Community Provider Law. We are requesting that this be extended to the qualified health plans that operate underneath the exchange. What the Essential Community Provider Law basically does is ensures that our state health plans offer contracts to safety net providers that are designated as essential community providers. What this does, in a sense, it makes sure that patients using a community health center have access to that community health center because it's often their first choice of care, given the cultural needs that they may have. So we're just respectfully asking that you do expand this philosophy to the health insurance exchange. Now, it's not explicit in Senate File 1 anywhere, and I understand it may come out later this session, but it's just kind of keeping this in mind as we move forward. So, again, the community health center support and really are ready to prepare to participate in the exchange as it moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. I lost my list here. Marie Ellis.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Marie Ellis, and I work at Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis. And I would like to heed your suggestion, Madam Chair, and so I will simply affirm what the previous testifiers stated about the extreme importance of community-based navigators. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Marie Ellis. You have a challenge in front of you, Stephen.
I do.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Steve Allen. I'm a private insurance agent up in the St. Cloud area. I also own multiple small businesses, and I also am aware of what goes on in health insurance. With 17 years experience in the large group as well as small group and individual markets, I would like to just provide a little bit of insight to you as to being down in the trenches daily. First of all, I'll make this as brief as I can, probably be right around 2 minutes, but we already have a private health insurance market in Minnesota. Minnesota is the envy of most states in the United States. We've got a wonderful system that's been set up, number one, not only for our small employers, but also on the individual basis. And as I'm sure all of you are well aware, we continue to hear about these unfortunate incidences that people can't get care in this state. I don't know where those people are coming from, but we do have what's called MCHA in Minnesota. If you're declined coverage by any carrier in the state of Minnesota, it is guaranteed issue to you. I would assume that most of you are aware of the program that was referred to earlier. That was to roll out through the Agent Coalition and in a partnership with Minnesota called the Healthy Minnesota Contribution Program. Unfortunately, when that rolled out, it was set up from the beginning to try and fail, in my estimation. We were supposed to have 4,100 participants that were going to participate. It ended up being 1,800. In my estimation, the amount of funds that were appropriated to the people that were current Minnesota Care participants in order to go into a defined contribution model versus a defined benefit model was not enough in contributions. I would assume that it was significantly less than what it costs the state of Minnesota currently to have those participants of Minnesota Care on Minnesota's doles as far as for health insurance coverage. I, as an individual health insurance for the last 8 years, have specialized in with large employers because in the state of Minnesota it would be considered illegal for me under Statute 62L to go to employers and offer to them a defined contribution model. And in that defined contribution model, they give their employees pay increases. And those employees can then use a defined contribution that goes in through pre-tax dollars and to go out into the marketplace and get individual insurance. What I have found overwhelmingly for the employers, number one, is we see average cost savings in the free market of about 30 to 50%, moving from large employer group health insurance, because we keep hearing large employers is it's cheaper than small employers. That's not the case that I find with being in the business. But I, on average, see 30 to 50% premium savings for the employer and the employee combined. As well, they add additional flexibility because I'm assuming everyone sitting around this table, your family makeup is completely different from all the rest. You may be single, you may be empty nesters, you might have young kids. What this does is instead of having the group style model, which in my estimation shouldn't be there to begin with, but it allows individuals to pick and choose what actually fits their needs the best. And I would be willing to bet that individuals in the state of Minnesota, if presented with either a voucher or if they're in the lower income brackets, lower to lower middle income brackets, could be good consumers of those dollars versus the systems where we've had where go in, it may cost you $40 a month to cover your whole family under Minnesota Care, and we'll give you 100% coverage, no out-of-pocket. I mean, that if we wonder why costs have gotten where they have, those are the reasons. We need consumerism and a marketplace injection back in and put it into individuals' hands. So another problem that I've solved, which I've heard it here at least two or three times today, that people, when they lost their job, then they lost their health and coverage, and being tied to your employer that way, I don't know if everybody likes that or if they like the penalties that way, but by using a defined contribution model like I do, when an employee and employer relationship terminates, that employee has their health insurance. It's their own individual insurance. They take it with them. So there is no COBRA. We don't have to go through all the rigmarole. So if we make things easier and get government not so intrusive in people's lives, you will find that things do work better in that model. So I think that's about all I have. But as far as with the health exchange, my biggest concern on the health exchange, or labeling it the health exchange, it should just be the information exchange, is that in order for people to even go in, and if they want to look at the limited options that will be provided in that exchange, they have to start entering in all of their private information, and then it's tied in with the Department of Justice, Homeland Security, IRS, I mean, all these other places where if you want to go to my website, and I heard a couple people say that they need to get some insurance or would like to look in one marketplace, you can go to my website, enter in your age, your spouse's age, do you use tobacco, and how many kids do you have, and it'll pull up every option available to you.
Thank you,
my
Mr.
number's
Elin.
On there. I'm Thank available
you.
24/7.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you.
Elin.
Madam Chair, can I ask just one quick question?
Senator Nino.
Thank you. You said you have 17 years in the insurance industry?
Correct.
Okay. And I'm going to ask a couple of questions, but they're intertwined, really, is one answer, I think. In your experience, has your clientele been better served by having more options available to them, a greater array of possibilities to look at for insurance, more flexibility to find the piece that's customized more towards their unique circumstance? Or in your experience, is that Minnesotans in general just don't have the wherewithal to make an educated decision and really need to have those options narrowed down for them? Which is it?
Are you talking about my individual clients or group clients?
Just when you're talking with, well both, I guess, but when you're okay. out there talking insurance.
Well, because it works both ways. Number one, there are so many different plans by so many different carriers that in the group market, it does get way too confusing. And as a broker, that's our job, is to go in, sit down, ask the critical questions. What would you like your health plan to do for you and your employees? Are you looking for this, this, and this? And then we narrow it down for them. That's why we're professionals in the industry. I do the same thing. It takes about 5 minutes when people call me. I can narrow it down to about five options that they would want to look at. Whether, you know, do you have children? Do you go into, are you looking for a copay if you go to a doctor's office? Or can you sustain, what is your financial tolerance to risk? If you were to have 4 or 5 years in a row of major medical claims, could you take on $10,000 a year in risk? Or would that make you lose your home? So I do ask them those questions and get them directed down to what would best meet their needs, as do, I'm sure, probably at least 30,000 out of the 54,000 agents in Minnesota.
Did you have a follow-up question, Senator Nino? Did you have a second question, did you say? No. Okay, thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Elaine Cunningham.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Elaine Cunningham. I'm the Outreach Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. Children's Defense Fund is a nonpartisan, non-profit organization that looks at policies that impact the lives of children and families, and we work for those policies. We have been involved as an organization in healthcare outreach since 1999, and we directly have connected uninsured families to Minnesota Care and to medical assistance. Currently, we direct a project called Bridge to Benefits. And Bridge to Benefits looks at not only the healthcare programs, but also the broader array of public programs, including food support and school meal program, the energy assistance program, and tax credits. We work with over 300 organizations across the state of Minnesota to do Bridge to Benefits. In 2012, we served 52,000 families, and that included 133,000 family members. And I mention this only in to show that we have spent a lot of time and effort in outreach, and we understand the importance of this kind of work in connecting families to the resources that they need. That leads me to my comments, and I want to reiterate our support for the Navigator program. as it is appears in the exchange, and also the importance of community-based organizations to be involved in that role. But I also want to stress that we think that a Navigator program needs to be a very coordinated statewide outfit that reaches all corners of the state. And I don't mean just by phone calls and by online assistance. I mean that it needs to have some sort of face-to-face component to it, because we understand the importance of face-to-face interaction in really helping families understand and connect to the resources that are available to them. We also think that compensation should be fairly tied to that face-to-face component because of the labor intensity of that kind of work. And then the other comments that I wanted to make are just around the funding mechanism of the exchange. I served on the financing work group as part of the exchange and representing the role of the navigators. And I just want to comment on a couple of things that we support that came out of the discussions in that work group around fair and equitable funding for the exchange that does not unfairly burden one entity. We support two sources of funding for the mechanism, one kind of base funding mechanism and one flexible funding mechanism that goes up and down with the business of the exchange. We support a premium fee. However, we would not support anything like taking healthcare access money for it until we know where something like the basic health plan and the Minnesota care population is going, because we want to make sure to reserve that money. So those are my comments, and I thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Senator Lurie, would you like to come back to the table? I appreciated the testimony, and I know that my request for you to be brief on a bill of this significance is difficult for you. I think, Senator Lurie, you've listened, and you've been hearing about a number of issues here. A number of the testifiers had different perspectives about any willing purchaser versus the active purchase program. There's a number of testifiers that talked about the composition of the board and the rulemaking, concerns about for a majority having control over the decision-making as opposed to whether or not that should be broadened. You've heard discussions about methods of reimbursing the navigators to make certain that if they have direct contact with people, that it may take a little bit more income in order to accomplish that. There was a presentation on diversity and about how the exchange really is important in terms of being able to have navigation in the system that takes into account diverse communities. There was a number of issues that were discussed through the testifiers, some of which I'm sure you've heard in other committees. So if you're ready, we can begin with a discussion, and I think that you have an amendment that you'd like to present to the bill.
I do. I have and you're right. I listened to, I think, 19 testifiers, and much of it we've heard in additional committees, and I guess maybe I'll just let the committee ask the questions they wish based on the testimony. Some of it, I can respond to most of it. But with that, I have a fairly technical A61 amendment that I would like the committee's indulgence in adopting. I think it was handed out in your packet initially, and there's nothing in here terribly controversial. And I can even offer it myself. It's the first committee I've been to that I actually belong to, so that's kind of handy.
Are you offering the
Madam Chair, I would offer the A61 amendment.
Amendment. To the to Senate File Number 1.
Yes.
Would you explain the amendment, please?
Yeah. Lines 1.2 to 1.6 are incredibly technical. They're just structuring the paragraphs in the right order. Line 1.7 is regarding teasing out of dental plans that we did in the last committee, and it's a technical fix of making sure that happens correctly. Lines 1.8 and 1.9 is another technical amendment to get at the intent of the amendment in the last committee. Line 1.10 is very technical regarding health care plan rather than health plan to be in sync with the definition. Lines 1.12 to 1.16 are actually not controversial, but not technical either. This is for the disability community, and it's some language to make sure that if a disabled individual presents on the exchange, either through one of the in-person manners or through the website, that they're not just simply kicked over to the existing county resources that help access to Medicaid for the non-MAGI population, MAGI being the modified adjusted gross income standard. That's the basic model for eligibility determinations through the exchange itself. And really, this is trying to get at the fact that for several of our disabled that could enter Medicaid through another option, the MAGI option might be a very powerful tool for them. So we want the exchange to make sure that they wrap around that individual and make certain that that individual understands the options that would be available to them through the exchange, rather than turning them over to like the old the existing MAEPD program. It might be very beneficial to go right through the MAGI and get eligibility through the exchange. And so making sure that those modules are available to better support our disability community is what this amendment is trying to get at. And so disability advocates brought this to me, and I think it's a wise amendment. Again, not technical, but also not terribly controversial. Lines 117 and 18 are technical, getting at what we're trying to do. Line 18 is actually kind of comical. We said at one point we were working on health prevention. Well, no, obviously we're not trying to prevent health. It's disease prevention is what we're trying to get at. 19, 20, 21, 22, all very technical, making sure that we're getting at the intent. 23 is teasing out the dental plans again. 124 to 128 are having the several of the reports that are coming back to the legislature go to the chairs and ranking minority members of commerce and health divisions. 129 to 136 is again teasing out the dental, and that's the extent of the A61.
Thank you. Is there any discussion on the A61 amendment? Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Senator Benson.
And Senator Lurie, this is the first time I've heard this bill. Well, it has been well discussed. And I just want to make sure when we're adding and dental plans, that was not what was in my head. So I'm having a little paradigm shift. The dental plans know this. They're okay with being grouped in with the health plans.
Senator Lurie.
Chair, Senator Benson, we are working with the folks in the dental community, and they are supportive of breaking their role out. It's required for pediatric dental to be covered. It's optional for other standalone dental plans. This leaves the option. It makes sure that we account for the required pediatric dental and just attributes them separately. In the initial drafting of the bill, they were kind of lumped together in a way that didn't really technically work very well. And so, yes, the dental community is working with us. I believe that beyond this committee, we may need to tease it out a little bit more, and I'm open to that. I don't think anybody's against what we're doing today. It may need to be teased out a little bit better in a couple of specific items that were just brought to us as I was walking up here, and I'm totally amenable to that.
Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, this is the Health Policy Committee, and so if Senator Lurie, if you could speak to those things that you think might not be acceptable to the dental community, I'd like to be better informed about this. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'd turn it over to...
I'm Joe Lally. I'm Vice President at Delta Dental. And we process dental claims for 4.2 million people and have a premium in excess of $1.2 billion annually. The distinction between dental plans and standalone dental plans and health plans is something that's already exists in statute in Minnesota. In the definitions in 62A and also in the Federal Health Care Reform Act. So this is just, it's consistent with that. Dental isn't the driving issue in health care reform, and so we're a little bit like the tail of the dog, but we agree with the separate but similar standards for certification. There are certain kinds of health plan, qualified health plan certification standards that just don't apply to dental. And so the work group this over the summer of the governor's task force and then the task force approved some qualified dental plan certification criteria, and the exchange staff published those this morning, in fact. And so we're supportive of these changes. There's some additional language. We just saw the amendment today, so there's additional language that we'll continue to talk with the author about, but we're supportive of the separation. But the motivation for it is because the criteria for health plan certification is separate from the criteria for a dental plan certification. If we're only selling standalone dental, there are a lot of things that just don't apply.
Senator Benson, you're set. Thank you very much. Thank you. Any other discussion on Senate File 61 or Amendment 61? Seeing none, the question is on the motion of Senator Lurie that Senate File 1 be amended as shown in the document labeled A61. As amended, all those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much. Is there any further discussion? Senator Benson.
And thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Lurie. There's been quite a bit of discussion about the active purchaser model and the ability for the exchange board to negotiate rates. And having not sat on commerce, I have a marginal understanding of the rate-setting process, and I'm wondering if there's somebody from Commerce or someone who has experience who could come forward and help us understand, because it was my understanding in rate-setting there's an actuarial kind of floor that's set in place, and so I want to know how this board can negotiate down to that floor, take away margins. I'd need some help with that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lurie.
Maybe I'd just speak to it initially and let Commerce, correct me if I get off. You know, I think there is a lot of confusion around here, but there's a couple of important things to talk about in regards to the smart purchasing authority on behalf of the board. You know, it's in my view, I think it's critical in order to drive value out of the market on behalf of consumers, and that's why it's in the bill. I do want it to work for carriers as well. One thing that's incredibly important is the authority to select is different than the exercise of selection. It was brought up in testimony that Massachusetts has the authority but has never exercised that authority. I think that spelling out selection criteria so that market participants know what they're asked to produce is a wise thing and really does help us with that. As far as active negotiation, this is kind of at the core of it, and the structure of the bill, what's allowed right now, is not active negotiation with carriers in regards to the costs of the plans. What is in the bill is contemplated for years two and forward is a rulemaking process whereby the board would adopt rules in consultation with the mandatory work groups that include industry stakeholders, understand what industry is looking for and work with them to adopt rules that specify what the criteria are and what the measurements that the criteria will be evaluated against will be, so that our carriers know the target that they're throwing their darts at. And so that's the place at which a bit of negotiation would go on. You know, this is what I can produce. This is what we're looking for. We're trying to meet these broad goals. Once those rules go into place, there's two prongs of that are required in the ACA for certification. There's the minimum certification requirements that would kind of be the any willing plan model. There's also secondary certification requirements that you can just refer back to prong one and be done, and that is just straight up the any willing plan model. But you actually do have to go through that secondary certification, and what we're saying is that the exchange ought to be authorized to add and evaluate additional criteria to make sure that plans are in the interests of consumers. It is my sincere goal to make this bill work for consumers and for industry. I mean, I fully believe that every single one of our carriers in Minnesota will be able to meet the standards that that'll be set for them to meet, and will have access to this new marketplace for their consumers. And I'm really sincere about that. So that's kind of the framework around it. Another important aspect to note is that even in the fiscal note, when they start taking a look at it, and I know that's not specifically before us, but the estimates are based on 10 carriers presenting, 7 to 10 carriers, and they're looking at estimates of 10, with 10 plans each. That's 100 plans being put forward. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of choice there. And making sure that this exchange is able to ensure in some manner that the choices presented are in the best interest of consumers is an important decision. But I hope that gets to some of the confusion that I know regards it is brought to the table oftentimes in regards to active negotiation. It is not the case that a plan that goes through the building process and gets approved by Commerce with a rate, at that point, the exchange in this bill is not authorized to negotiate that rate down. And so anybody who heard that, you know, that's or said that, that's not accurate. The negotiation would go in terms of making sure that the certification requirements are sound, and that's what we're looking for. And in judiciary, we added for any plan who feels that they were aggrieved in that process and that they, you know, we had certification criteria. I believe I hit the target and provided a plan that met that criteria. And the board, you know, we heard willy-nilly excludes that plan. They have a contested case hearing, a very thorough process to go and challenge them. They have the criteria that were intended to be met and the measurement standards upon which those criteria will be evaluated and will be treated fairly and given due process to state their grievances. So,
thank you, Senator Lurie. We have a representative from the Department of Commerce, but I'll turn to Senator Benson to make sure that in the time we have that we're focused on what it is that you're asking. Well, what you would you appreciate from the Department
of
Commerce?
Madam Chair, are you intending that all of our questions would be answered in 20 minutes, or are you planning to extend time today?
I'm intending to take action on this bill by the end of today. I don't know that I'll be able to answer all your questions about other portions of the bill other than are the jurisdiction of this committee.
Okay, and so you don't consider the active purchaser to be part of our jurisdiction?
Yes, the active purchaser is part of our jurisdiction.
Okay, and thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Lurie. Was my understanding that out of that very broad pool of 100, the board would have the authority to negotiate down to those choices, to eliminate people who might not be perceived as the best value for consumers. It seems that authority is in here and is very broad. And if you could address that wouldn't happen, you as the chief author have a lot of authority to state that won't happen.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, you know, as I presented this amendment to the Commerce Committee last week, I did frame the year one is what you're seeing with the six specific criteria, which is on page 9, beginning on line 923. But that's for year one, and I framed that as a work in progress. I'm working with the carriers to try to make sure that we understand each other, and we're trying to get a bare bones set of criteria that gives them the assurance of what the marketplace is going to be looking for and what they can measure. But I'm open to working with them on year one certification criteria. If you go down a little further in paragraph F on the same page, 9.32. For plans offered in 2015 and forward, the board has to establish certification criteria by February 1st of every year, with the certification criteria, including the measure to be used to determine whether the criteria have been met. And that's actually, you know, language that was brought to me by the plans as, you know, not as something that they support, but if we're going to do, if we're going to give this board some power to leverage better values on behalf of consumers, I ask the plans, a big ask for them to come forward with what mechanism would work best for you, and this is what they brought forward, almost verbatim. Year one, of course, we don't have time to promulgate rules by February 1st, and so I took a stab at it. And we have the six that are listed there, reasonableness of expected costs, quality and sufficiency of the networks, quality improvement activities, quality initiatives related to cultural and linguistic competencies, promotion of initiatives for improving health and disease prevention, and providing a manageable number of choices to consumers that present clear product differentiation. I believe that we're really narrowing in. And I'll admit, I did at every committee stop that as this was introduced, it just said, can select in the interest of consumers. And that's very, very, very broad and created a lot of nerves in the community, and I understand why. So we're really trying to narrow that target, make sure that it's a manageable target, and that our plans have the, you know, a reasonable assurance that if they put out good products, they can get them on the market and be an active player.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Lori, as you talked about negotiating value, maybe this would be an opportunity for Commerce, and I'll relieve our testifier of time at the table if she could just explain how plans are certified and actuarial soundness is determined, because if we're negotiating value, that somehow says to me that there's not value existing in the marketplace, that the exchange could negotiate it, and so I'd like an explanation.
Madam Chair and Senator, my name is Emily Johnson Piper. I'm Deputy Commissioner and Chief of Staff at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. And what I understand your question to be is how are rates reviewed generally at the department? So, and how we envision rate filings coming in for plans on the exchange. Is that correct? So we have identified a date certain by which we need plans to file by at the Commerce Department to be considered, to be appropriately actuarially evaluated for consideration on the exchange by the beginning of open enrollment in 2013. And the date, I believe, is the middle of May, where plans will file their products on SERF, which is our rate filing system, or our product filing system. Our actuaries will then review them, and it will be, and our product filing staff will review the products as well, and they will determine whether or not they are compliant with Minnesota law for sale in the Minnesota insurance marketplace. For those products sold on the exchange, it's understood that there will be criteria identified for purposes of the evaluation relating to the certification of plans, and that will also be part of the review process that's conducted for those plans related to the exchange. But all of the plans will be reviewed as they normally would for, whether or not, from a rates perspective, whether or not the rates are excessive or should be. These plans should be offered for sale in the state of Minnesota. Nothing in the exchange's review process or certification process will at all limit the review that normally happens with respect to product filings through the Commerce Department for the insurers subject to Commerce's jurisdiction.
And Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Johnson-Piper. So my question is then, in the rate setting process, is there enough cushion built in to the rates so that there can be a 3.5% withhold and the exchange can negotiate down cost for the value proposition?
Well, I defer to the exchange to discuss the 3.5% withhold, but there is, once a rate is filed with the Department of Commerce, that's the rate that's reviewed under Minnesota law. And I don't believe that the exchange is representing that it would try and modify that rate during the rate review process. If it did, an insurer would have to refile its rates for, a review of an amended rate, essentially, before it was allowed for sale.
Senator Lori, you wanted to say something.
No, that's fine. Ms. Johnson-Piper said that. I mean, the exchange cannot, once a rate has been set, that is the rate that would be charged for that plan. And that's true. And we're not changing that in this statute.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I have a few questions. I'll try and be really brief. My biggest concern with this, Senator Lori, is this active purchaser model. And we've had a lot of discussion about it already, so certainly I don't want to reiterate all of that. But I'm really grappling with trying to understand what is the value of having that active purchaser model? We already have determined or will determine what the qualified health plans are. So if those parameters are already being met, why would we want the Minnesota government to come in and say only certain plans that are meeting that criteria or those parameters are allowed on the exchange? What are you driving at here?
Senator Lori.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson. We're driving at better value for consumers. Maybe one of the best examples is, you know, our state Medicaid program today. I mean, the upcoming biennium that we're setting a budget for has $1 billion in savings in it that is redirected to other programs within our HHS budget, as the governor has presented it. That value largely being driven by the competitive bidding process, the profit caps, and the growth caps imposed on today's market. And those are, you know, not exactly the same tools, but some set of tools. And this is really a pretty minimal set of tools to drive value out of the market. We're going to tell plans ahead of time, carriers, what the criteria for participation in the marketplace is going to be, and the measurements against which those criteria will be met. And that's where the negotiation piece will come in. So by February 1st each year, at that point, then the plans will develop the products and go through the rate setting process to meet that target. And if they've missed it, you know, the board can not allow, make it so that plan can't get on to the exchange. My guess is that at that point, that carrier would probably go through that contested case hearing and challenge the decision of the board. And that's why we set it up in there, actually. We added that in the Judiciary Committee to make sure that, because it's a big business decision for plans. And so again, I'll reiterate, I really want plans to be able to have access to this market and to these consumers, these individuals, these families, these small businesses, but I want them to put out good plans, and I know that they can. And so if we're explicit about what those criteria are, I think we can get there.
Senator Nelson and then Senator Benson, and we are coming up on the time that we would end. Now, as I've said, unless people really have questions, we can delay action to 6 o'clock tonight. I will put this committee in recess till six tonight if we need to continue past 2:30. But if we're able to answer questions prior to that time and people are comfortable, we'll move ahead with a vote. Senator Nelson and Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Senator Lori, what I heard you say is it's about driving value. That's why you would have an active purchaser model. I think that's what you told me. And yet that kind of brings me to my next question, which has to do with the makeup of the board. We know that what we're really addressing here is the high cost of health care is really what we're addressing here, and then how to drive value is what I hear you saying. And yet we know that it's really the science of health care delivery that can help drive value in healthcare, and yet I don't see any of that reflected in the makeup of the board. And I'd kind of like you to comment on that,
Senator Lori.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, I would both agree and disagree with some of your comments. And it's a very good question. I would certainly agree that this Senate File 1 is not healthcare reform. This is health insurance reform. But it's a good foundation upon which to build true and meaningful healthcare reform. But the products offered need to meet the needs of consumers, individuals, families, small businesses, and making sure that the exchange is able to act on behalf of consumers is a critical piece of being able to do that. So I will accept that this is not healthcare reform, and we have much work to do in that field. This is just a foundation upon which to build it, but that driving value out of the insurance system is also part of that foundational work to make sure that the needs of consumers are met as we engage in the much more broader discussions regarding the healthcare reform.
Madam Chair, I'll be real brief. Just ask two questions at once and try and get a quick answer.
Thank you.
I know we're tied here for time.
This is the speed round.
Senator Nelson, the speed round.
My question, I'm so sorry. My question has to do with then, and you kind of talked about reimbursement rates, I think. Did I hear you say this is not about driving value through reimbursement rates? Did I hear
no,
you say?
I didn't.
That's
Chair,
one of two.
That is, okay. So so on 6.4, where it says that the plans can contract for the receipt and provision of goods and services. I'd like to know, does that entail broad negotiation about reimbursement rates? And then my last question is a very simple one, but it has to do with Section 9 on funds and about dedicated funds. And the question there is, we have a history of using funds for other things in this state, and so when your bill says dedicated funds, does that mean those funds are only available for this intended purpose, or can the state of Minnesota to do some sort of a shift, or can the state of Minnesota somehow raid those funds?
Senator Lori?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, contract for the receipt and provision of goods and services is getting legal service. It's not about healthcare services. You know, you need a computer, you can buy it. You need IT support, so you can get it. You know, they need to be able to contract with entities to bring that in. So this is that first question is
yes,
in the general powers of the marketplace, and it is not about buying healthcare services. So I hope that's responsive.
Yes.
The second question was about the 3.5% withhold and the dedicated funds, and it is a withhold that would be dedicated to that purpose. The structure of the bill does not provide for annual or biennial review of that by the legislature, but of course this entire board is a creation of the legislature and always subject to any changes that the legislature wishes to impose. The intent of that 3.5% up to 3.5% withhold, it is anticipated to go down significantly in year two and then further in year three as participation rates pick up. But that is the ability for the board to have certainty that they are going to be able to operate. We're looking at how they're going to operate. We have several reports coming back to the legislature. We will continue to have extensive legislative oversight of this board and ask questions, and I fully intend to be an active participant in that and bring these reports and treat them seriously, engage the Office of the Legislative Auditor in making sure that the needs are broadly being addressed by this board.
So thank you, Senator Lori. I think Senator Benson is next, and then Senator Rosen. Senator
Thank
Benson.
You, Madam Chair, and Senator Lori, when you talked about the negotiations that were done by the Department of Human Services on the public plans and saved $1 billion, government was buying those plans and so was in a place to negotiate. Does the exchange anticipate buying plan options, or is that for the consumers to do?
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Lori.
Senator Benson, no, it is not the exchange's ability to buy plans or interact in that manner. And I also said that it's not an exact, it's not the same tools, but it is some tools for leveraging value on behalf of consumers. And it's not a perfect fit, but it's a good example of the need to make sure that you have some of those tools at your disposal. You know, I characterize what we experienced prior to when competitive bidding and profit caps and growth caps were imposed. It was akin to an any willing plan model. And, you know, it wasn't until those tools came online and started being imposed on the marketplace that we saw these significant savings. And so it's a real example of how important making sure that at some level these tools exist. And I tried to make the tools manageable also for the carriers, and we'll continue to try. They're going to come meet with me later today, I believe, if we can't make that, if we're back here, maybe not. But we're going to keep trying to work on year one. I want these tools to be manageable, but I need, we need this exchange in some way to be able to negotiate, to leverage value out of the marketplace.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure if Senator Nelson's question is complete yet either. But and I feel your issue here about wanting to get done. But we have a lot of questions coming up, and this is a major change on our health policy going forward. And so I feel very rushed. I have the pleasure of seeing it in the Health Budget Committee going forward. But many people are done with it after this. Committee. So I am feeling a little frustrated that.
Yes, I can feel that as well. That's why I mentioned that if people are really at least on the subject areas for which we are responsible, if people want to continue to explore more deeply, I'm willing to do that. And my goal was to try to make it through, but if people are really wanting to come back together at 6 today, we will stay until we complete our work today, and it will be in this meeting room at 6 o'clock if that's the preference of the committee. Senator Benson.
And Madam Chair, if my timing is correct, this committee has had about 20 minutes for questions on this very important subject, and so unless... I am on the Health Budget Committee, and so maybe we can have more hearings there. But if we want to finish the purview of this committee, I think it's reasonable that we take some additional time. And I can work with my team, and we can focus on, you know, I went a little far afield, but we can focus and try to get done the things that are purview of this committee. But 20 minutes is not very much time for transformative legislation.
That's fine. Since we are at our time, I think that what we'll need to do then is recess this committee, Senator Lori, and we'll recommend we'll reconvene at 6 p.m. in this room. We will reconvene on time. On time.
I'll be here, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Lori.
Thank you.
Great.